You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hurricane Ida is the latest severe storm to highlight risks to infrastructure in the United States, from washed out roads to flooded subways. We'll talk to an expert to learn more about our infrastructure and what might need to change to adapt during climate change. Now, a Texas law went into effect this week that effectively bans abortions after about 6 weeks into pregnancy. This may be the biggest challenge to the national precedent of Roe v. Wade since the 1973 decision. The court responded this week to an emergency petition aimed at stopping the law from going into effect while it goes through the court system. Justices voted 5-4 not to stand in its way. So that law is in effect now in Texas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how this new law works, who it affects, who it does not affect? What's your response to this law going to into effect and the Supreme Court's decision to not stop it, at least for now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. She's one of the leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in America. Her most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us exactly what this Texas law does?
So this Texas law authorizes literally anyone, the word is any person, other than a state or local official, to bring a lawsuit against anyone who performs an abortion after 6 weeks of into pregnancy, or anyone who aids or abets someone seeking an abortion at that point. And that, of course, is before many people know they're pregnant. This is a variation of laws people may be familiar with, the so-called heartbeat bills. What's different, of course, is that most heartbeat bills criminalize these procedures. Texas creates these lawsuits. And there's kind of, that sounds weird. It sounds weird for a state to say we're going to create a law and then stop our own officials from enforcing it. But there's a kind of a strategy behind the madness.
Can you talk about that strategy? Why approach it in that way?
Well, Texas was hoping to avoid a potential loss in the Supreme Court. So other states that have passed heartbeat bills have occasionally had to pay through the nose, particularly they've had to pay attorney's fees to abortion providers who brought constitutional lawsuits. And so Texas lawmakers had demurred when previously thinking about passing a heartbeat bill, but they decided as an alternative that they would introduce this bill to insulate themselves from liability. So how that works, there's a doctrine called sovereign immunity in U.S. law that limits when you can sue a state. And the exception to that is that you often can sue an official who's enforcing an unconstitutional law. The ingenious thing Texas did was to say, essentially, we've told you no state official can enforce this law, so there's no state official you can sue in federal court. So whether this law is unconstitutional or not, there's nothing you can do about it, at least not in federal court, which is how we've ended up where we are.
So with this enforcement, any private citizen, as I understand it, can say, hey, I think this organization has performed an abortion after 6 weeks, say, and then what happens? It doesn't go into a criminal court, but a civil court?
Yep. And then that person can receive a minimum of $10,000. From the person either performing the abortion, and it's worth saying helping someone get an abortion. It's worth unpacking what the aiding or abetting thing actually means, because that could be, you know, a boyfriend or husband whose partner is sexually assaulted is bringing them to the abortion clinic. That person could get sued. Arguably, you know, that you have to knowingly aid or abet. So anyone who's sort of inadvertently involved may not get sued, but other people, anything from advocacy groups to transportation providers to family members to friends, could all be sued for this minimum of $10,000 as well.
So on a practical level, what's happening in Texas right now with abortion providers?
Abortion providers have announced for the most part that they're not planning on performing procedures after the sixth week of pregnancy anymore because this law is in effect. And beyond that, what's happening is that there's sort of an arms race, if you will, between abortion rights supporters and abortion opponents, where abortion rights supporters are trying to offer options to people outside of the state and to make it easier for people in the state to leave to get those options, whether that's getting abortion medication mailed to them or travel across state lines to get a procedure. And the state is beginning to explore options to shut down those alternatives. So it's kind of a mess now. It's going to be kind of unpredictable. And at the same time, Texas anti-abortion groups have set up websites and other places, tip lines, where you can report people that you think are either performing abortions or aiding or abetting someone who is.
Talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, looking at this law now in effect in Texas, taking a unique approach, in effect stopping abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. As our guest mentioned, often before people know they're pregnant. You can join in with your questions, thoughts, reactions at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Mary, I want to visit now the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't sit and hear the case. They decided in this 5-4 decision to not block this law pending it going up through the court system. Can you talk about that decision and what it means?
Well, so this is part of a kind of weird feature of what the court does that scholars like me call the shadow docket. So most of the time, if you hear about the there's been oral argument, there's been briefing, everything has been done in the light of day, but the court handles these emergency appeals in a very different way. So there's no arguments, there's no briefing. The opinions don't always even have, you know, reasoning, or it's not always clear who's decided what. And that shadow docket's grown exponentially in recent years, and it's grown to include more and more controversial matters like abortion. So the court here isn't saying ultimately that the law is unconstitutional or not, but these kinds of emergency orders still tell us a lot, because the court is supposed to allow a law like this to go into effect only if the justices believe that it's quite likely to be considered constitutional, or at least there's no vehicle for challenging its constitutionality when the case is fully litigated down the line. And so the justices here were hinting that that was what they were going to conclude when the case got to that point.
And as I understand it, Mary, a handful of other states are at least potentially going to pursue almost identical laws to what we're seeing in Texas. Do you expect to see similar laws, especially in Republican-controlled states?
I do. I mean, I think if the Supreme Court is really going to sign off on this business model, I would also expect to see similar laws involving other constitutional rights in more Democratic-controlled states, too. If the Supreme Court is serious that, you know, you can pass a law saying you may have a constitutional right, but people can sue you for $10, and as long as the state doesn't enforce it, it's good. It's not going to stop with abortion, right? I mean, states are going to experiment with everything from, you know, the right to bear arms to vaccine mandates to the right to free speech. I mean, it's not going to, but as already we've seen Arkansas and Florida announce that they're going to pursue legislation like this when it comes to abortion, but I think that's going to just be the tip of the iceberg.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Laura is calling from Illinois. Laura, hello.
Yes, hello. I'm calling basically because I had two illegal abortions before Roe versus Wade. I'm 70 years old now. Those abortions were done, the first one was done by a doctor in a hotel room. I was taken to a hotel room, and that's where it was performed. The other one was done, I was blindfolded in a van with other women, and we were taken to some unknown facility where the abortions were performed. So what I want to say is that women will find a way to have an abortion. We just need it to be safe and legal.
Laura, thank you for sharing your experience with us. Mary, your thoughts on the idea that we might be returning to some of what Laura experienced herself?
I think that's realistic. I mean, the things that have changed in the years since primarily involve the availability of medication abortion. So there are non-governmental organizations that exist primarily to get medication abortion to people in either countries or communities where abortion is illegal. And self-managed abortion, at least the research suggests, is relatively safe if certain protocols are followed. So that said, of course, the experience of women in past years won't completely be gone. And that's particularly going to be true for people who are lower income, more often people of color, who are the ones who disproportionately have abortions at high rates, and also the people who are probably going to have some of the least access to money, to information, and who may try to end their own pregnancies in ways that aren't safe. So hopefully there have been improvements to medical care in the years since that will change the picture some, but I don't think as entirely as we might like.
Laura, thanks for that call. We're talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, leading authority on the legal history of abortion in the United States. We're looking at the new law just in effect this week in Texas, essentially banning most abortions, especially after 6 weeks, using this system where government officials wouldn't enforce it, but private citizens would start a process of civil lawsuits. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this Texas law would work, the future of abortion in the United States, and Roe versus Wade in the current makeup of the Supreme Court? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about the new Texas law effectively banning abortions in the state after 6 weeks. It went into effect this week. Mary Ziegler is with us from the Florida State University College of Law. Her books include Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jess is with us in Genoa. Jess, hi.
Hi. I was just curious, what's to stop someone from accusing one of the legislators who voted for this law, or even the governor of Texas for signing it, of having performed one of these procedures, since it's my word against yours and, you know, not a criminal case? So, you know, I'm just curious.
Interesting. So what does somebody have to establish, Mary, to start this civil process against somebody they allege has performed an abortion, as Jess is saying, whether they've actually done it or not?
Well, we already know that there are people who oppose this law who are kind of trolling legislators. So there's a tip line, as I mentioned, the Texas Right to Life has set up. And what's already happened is that people opposed to the law have been flooding that tip line with exactly what the caller mentioned, like false complaints, arguing that, you know, Governor Greg Abbott is, you know, performing abortions or helping people perform abortions, and claiming that he's helping, you know, Shrek and cartoon characters get abortions. So that's already happening. In terms of what you would need to prove, it really is kind of a he said, she said sort of situation, in the sense that you're not obviously very often going to get direct evidence that an abortion is happening, much less that someone is aiding or abetting somebody seeking abortion. So more often you're probably going to have, you know, allegations that someone, for example, went to Planned Parenthood or was talking about abortion. I mean, it's really incentivizing neighbors to inform on one another to get money, because there's almost a sort of guarantee of $10,000 if you do report, and that's, you know, being put in place at a time when some people are hurting economically.
Thanks a lot for that call. I also wanted to ask about the legal process that could get this law into a full-on U.S. Supreme Court case. What would have to happen to allow someone to challenge this law in the courts that might start that process to get it to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's litigation is continuing in the federal district court. But again, the Texas is arguing that it shouldn't have to be there at all, and that it's immune from suit. And we would expect, based on what's happened so far, that both the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the intermediate appellate court, and the U.S. Supreme Court would accept that argument, because they've accepted it up until this point in the litigation. That said, obviously, there are other challenges that are proceeding in the state courts. And there also can be federal what are called as applied challenges. So instead of arguing that the law is just unconstitutional across the board, abortion providers who actually do, you know, perform these procedures and get sued could argue that specific lawsuits are unconstitutional. But they'd have to be willing, of course, to perform those abortions and risk the legal liability that would involve in order to test the law.
Let's go back to our callers now. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hello.
Hello. I am, I don't practice or believe in abortions, but at the same time, I'm pro-choice. Just for this reason, I was a because getting an abortion or, you know, having that procedure done is, it's like you can't really, and it almost reminds me of like the Salem witch trials, because it's something where, what if somebody like accidentally gets a miscarriage or something happens where, but all it takes is for your neighbor to be like, oh, you had an abortion. You're like, what? And then you can get sued, and anybody enabling you can get embedded, you know, that's empowering that can get sued too. To me, it's just, it just reminds me of like the Salem witch trials. There's no way of really proving a lot of this stuff.
Troy, thanks for the call. Mary, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real concern because, I mean, even if you know, let's just say you're not even pregnant, right? You're just a person of reproductive age. Somebody could still accuse you of getting an abortion. And even if they can't prove it, you'd have to go to court and deal with all the hassle. And of course, that's going to be even more true of people with pregnancy loss, where that could be like if you have a miscarriage or a stillbirth, where that could be mistaken for an abortion. I think the Salem witch trials comparison is not a bad one because this is incentivizing people to report on their neighbors. And I mean, even worse in some ways, because in the Salem witch trials, we can assume that people were doing that for, you know, for attention or because they were affected in some ways by some kind of health condition. Here, we're really looking instead at people who might just be doing this for the money, right? I mean, each time somebody supposedly aids or abets in an abortion or performs an abortion, that's $10,000. So you could do over and over and over again to make money, and there's no real requirement that you only be actually trying to find people who performed abortions. You may mistakenly believe someone aided or abetted. You may not even be sincere. But yeah, all of those are real concerns.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, looking at the new Texas law on abortion. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. You know, statutory rape is a crime, so I'm suggesting a mandatory minimum prison sentence for every statutory rapist where the rape ends up in a live birth. So if a baby is born to a female who was under 18 when she got pregnant and the father was over 18, he gets a mandatory minimum sentence and he can't buy his way out and he can't marry his way out. I'm thinking 18 years is about right. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Chris, thanks for the call. And Mary, exceptions we often hear about in abortion laws for things like statutory rape or rape or incest, are those there in this Texas law?
No, in short. So there's no rape or incest exception. So many of the common exceptions that you would see in an abortion ban are not in this law. And so, you know, if you have, for example, just to take an example that's realistic, if you have a child who's sexually assaulted, to use the caller's example, not even statutory rape, let's just take straight up vanilla sexual assault, and you want to take that child, you know, can be like a 12-year-old to get an abortion, you can be sued. That's sort of the reality of the law. Anybody, rape and incest doesn't matter. There's a limited sort of severe health emergency exception. That is very, very narrow, but that's the only thing that really excuses abortions or aiding or abetting abortion under the law.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We'll go next to Sandra in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hi.
Hi. I found a writing from Lance Wilburn, which really sums up everything I'm thinking about. The irony of all abortion bills is a complete lack of male inclusion. Now, when I noticed the governor of Texas in that photo op, I think 80% of the people standing behind him were older white males. Women do not magically become pregnant. There's a man attached to every single abortion. And why are they not being included in the jail time? It's because this really isn't about abortion. It's about men controlling women. It's an easy topic for white men to flex their power over to remind women that they will always be under them. If we were actually about abortion, we would be discussing early and continuing sex ed, free birth control, health care for all, making child care financially feasible, mandatory parental leave, increasing
Sandra, I'm going to jump in because we don't have much time left, but Mary, your thoughts on Sandra's points.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, because there is, I mean, this law, I guess, does try to be egalitarian in a weird kind of bizarre way by allowing you to sue men if they help their partners get abortions. But generally speaking, I think there isn't really, in a lot of these states, certainly in Texas, there's unsurprisingly very high rates of maternal mortality, often in the places that limit access to abortion the most. And that isn't inevitable, right? I mean, you could have a state that did fund things like contraception, sex education, neonatal and maternal care, especially for low-income folks who are going to be at the highest risk for complications. But often that's not how our politics work, and that's often how we end up with policies like this.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Just in our last minute, what are you watching for next as this story goes on?
Well, the Supreme Court has another major abortion case before it that's coming up this term that we should hear about an answer in by the end of the summer of 2022, actually probably early summer 2022, that could spell the end for Roe v. Wade altogether. It involves a Mississippi law that bans abortion at 15 weeks. That violates what Roe says now, which is that you have a right to choose abortion before viability. And so the fact that the court took that case when it had others available to it suggests that this court is ready either to overrule Roe or to take a significant step in that direction. So even before the Texas law gets back to the court, everyone should keep an eye on that Mississippi case.
Mary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. We talked to her today about the new law that went into effect in Texas this week, effectively banning abortions after 6 weeks. Coming up, we'll look at our roads, bridges, and other infrastructure may have to adapt to a future of climate change, with storms affecting most of the East Coast right now, wildfires in the West, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's this week's edition of the Friday News Roundup with a look at the end of America's longest war and a White House welcome for Ukraine's president, plus China takes aim at video games. That's all to come today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Hurricane Ida tore through the southern United States this weekend, including Louisiana and Mississippi. As the storm made its way through the northeastern part of the U.S. over the last few days, we've seen significant flooding along roadways, washed out highways, ongoing power outages, and more. Hurricane Ida is being held up as an example of the ways that storms are getting stronger as a result of climate change. And as we see more severe weather, not just hurricanes, we're going to see more of an impact on our infrastructure. That, in turn, is going to impact our safety, as we've seen around the country, sometimes even here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about our infrastructure and how it could weather a changing climate? How worried are you about the impact of climate change on our roads, bridges, power grids, and more? If you've gone through a severe storm, what have you seen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Joseph Schofer is Professor Emeritus of Civil and Environmental Engineering for the McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University. He also hosts the Infrastructure Show podcast. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, as we watch the progress of Hurricane Ida, I mean, a lot of infrastructure right there on the screen washed out. What are you thinking as you watch the progress of this storm?
Well, I'm not happy about it. That's a useful question. What am I thinking? I study infrastructure, and particularly I study the resilience of infrastructure. So for me, this is a learning experience, despite the suffering that people go through. And arguably, it's a learning experience for our leaders and for us as individuals to see what happens in the face of a terrible storm like this and to think through how we can be better prepared. How can we secure our infrastructure, and how can we secure ourselves? So every time there's a disastrous event like this, it presents a learning opportunity, and it's to our advantage to learn from it.
One lesson learned, some people have pointed out, is the things we did in the New Orleans area after Hurricane Katrina seem to have helped with Ida. Can you talk about what we've seen in the performance of post-Katrina infrastructure changes that might have saved maybe a lot of lives?
Well, Rob, I like the way you said it. You said the investments seem to have helped. The story is not completely in. Mm. And despite the fact that we've invested something like $14.5 billion in protection from storm surges and flooding, and those systems seem to have worked, Ida was a different storm than Katrina in a variety of ways, in terms of strength, in terms of duration, and particularly in terms of track. And so it tested some parts of the infrastructure, and it didn't test other parts. However, it does seem that there were no major failures, and that's a huge credit, because in the case of Katrina, again, a different storm, there were massive failures and the loss of something more than 1,800 lives. So we didn't have that in this case. Other things failed, but the flooding was not nearly the problem it was before.
Now, thinking about the way I asked that question, did the last disaster help us get things in place for a future disaster? Is there a more proactive way to think about things, though, instead of let's learn from this disaster to prevent future ones, trying to figure out how we can be ready before that big disaster?
Yeah, well, you're asking us to be smarter than we usually are, and you should ask that question. So, but it's a two-part question, or I'm going to make it that. Yes, we learned from Katrina. We learned a lot from Katrina. We learned things that are not so visible. So we learned to protect parts of New Orleans from storm surge and from flooding. And that investment, I think, was a good investment, and it will pay off in large amounts in the future. It's interesting for me to observe that other places learn from Katrina. So, for example, New York City was better prepared for Tropical Storm Sandy, which created similar storm surges a number of years later, because leadership, particularly in the transportation sector, said, we see what's going on in New Orleans, let's not let it happen to New York. So the learning was widespread. Can we anticipate? Yes, we can anticipate. It's hard, because what you're really asking people to do is to invest resources, invest money, to prepare for something that hasn't happened yet, but might happen, and that investment might pay off. So there's a lot of uncertainty in that. And it's hard to get the public and its leaders to make those kinds of financial commitments. It's not that we don't do it, but these are hard decisions to make.
And we buy insurance as individuals. Is that the kind of mindset we need as a society?
Well, that's the right question to ask, Rob. Yes, we're really talking about insurance in the form of infrastructure investments to protect ourselves in the future. However, think about this, that look at the people who could buy flood insurance that don't buy flood insurance. So not everybody buys insurance. People decide to take the risk. And when these long-term infrastructure resilience investments are competing against an investment with a short-term payoff, a project that we feel we need to invest in right now because it's going to pay off next year, sometimes it's really hard for decision makers to say, no, we'll wait on the current investment and we'll invest for the long term. Difficult decisions to make.
We are talking about infrastructure and climate change. Joseph Schoeffer is with us, Professor Emeritus at the McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University. You can hear him on the Infrastructure Show podcast. Joseph, climate change, how does that change the way we try to make these predictions, try to make these investments to prevent damage from our changing weather systems?
Well, so one of the ways we predict the future is we learn from the past, and we collect data on the past and project that into the future. And that's really one of the ways that we predict the risk from disastrous natural hazards. So we can talk about, for example, it's a really unfortunate term, but the 100-year mm-hmm. flood, which is really a flood that has a chance of 1% in any one year, one out of 100. The problem that climate change presents us with is the 100-year flood is coming every 50 years or every 25 years. So the pattern is changing, and we don't fully understand how that pattern is changing, but it's not getting better. It's very clear that it's getting worse. So it makes the prediction, the long-term prediction, more difficult.
Joseph, of course, there's two infrastructure bills before Congress right now. If legislative leaders came to you and said, Joseph, we want to earmark some of this stuff for climate resilience in infrastructure, what would be at the top of your triage list to put that money into?
Well, let me turn that around and say, so you're talking about spending $1 trillion, really a $500 billion in new spending. And what I would say is every major investment that you make ought to be made with resilience to natural disasters in mind. That is, we ought to be building resilience at every opportunity, not necessarily the smallest projects, but any large project ought to be selected and designed so that it gives us another layer of climate resilience. That is quite possible. It's just a matter of making sure that that is on the agenda when we make these investments. The really important aspect of this infrastructure bill, or these infrastructure bills, is that the money be spent well, with good information, good data, and thoughtful design, and with, in this case, with resilience in mind.
Now, a few years back, we had some serious flooding in northern Wisconsin along Lake Superior, washed out some roads. And I heard from some local officials up there who said, yeah, this federal relief money, they would pay for us to rebuild exactly the road that got washed out, not to upgrade it to prevent it being washed out in a future storm. Have you encountered that kind of thing before? That
yes, I have. I have heard that. I can't say that I've encountered it personally, but I've had people with state departments of transportation tell me exactly that. So that's one of the failures of federal policy, that we're so concerned about spending the money in a careful way, in a thoughtful way, and not overspending, that we're not looking ahead. We're not looking a decade or two decades or three decades ahead and saying, this could come back to us again. Let's prevent the damage that we experienced. So that requires a change in federal policy, a change in federal criteria. I would say that there are some federal programs that permit building at a higher level of resilience, but they take some extra justification. I don't mind the extra justification, but I think it's really important. You know, if you get flooding in your basement 6 inches deep, you want to think about the possibility that the next time it's going to be 2 feet deep, and let's try to prevent that.
We are talking about climate change and the future of our infrastructure around the United States. Joseph Schoffer stays with us, Professor Emeritus of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest on what we would need to do to climate change proof our infrastructure as much as we can anyway? Do you have a personal experience living in a community affected by some sort of disaster, a storm, a hurricane if you've lived elsewhere in the country, not so much here in Wisconsin, wildfire, the list goes on. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about infrastructure as climate change creates stronger and stronger storms and other risks of natural disasters that can have a big impact on human-made infrastructure. Joseph Schoffer is with us, Professor Emeritus of Civil and Environmental Engineering for the McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University. He hosts the Infrastructure Show podcast. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Have you ever moved or thought about moving because of the risk of flooding or storms or droughts or wildfires in an area? Do you think as we are looking to spend infrastructure money, we need to think about it differently in the way we build our stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've lived in places like northern Wisconsin hit by flooding, Gays Mills, other places that have taken a hit from some form of disaster, love to hear your experience. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Joseph, we hear sometimes that with places in the course of hurricanes or facing flooding or wildfires on the western part of the country, worst case scenarios where people think, should we live here anymore? Should we have communities in the face of these kind of disasters? How do we make those kind of decisions?
These are hard decisions to make, mm-hmm. but increasingly you're seeing people make them. Increasingly around the world, there are governments that are stepping in and helping people to relocate in a strategic way. There are some locations which are not really viable. And what we've been doing over the years is subsidizing people to live in those locations. For example, we subsidize flood insurance for people that live in flood zones. And it's relatively easy for people to collect on to experience the damage, collect on the insurance, and then but stay in those locations and stay exposed to hazards. And I think there are cases, and there's certainly not everywhere, but there are cases where we ought to consider helping people to relocate out of zones of danger.
How?
And it's hard because you're really typically you're saying, I want you to leave your home, and people don't want to leave their home. So we have to facilitate that in cases where the balance between costs and the benefits of living in a location are really not favorable for society.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Eau Claire. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you? So my comment was in regards to the thousands and thousands of acres of wetlands and fens and Everglades that are drained and have been drained over the centuries for construction. And, you know, that was created by nature as a buffer for hurricanes and flooding. And just wondering how that lends into how we change our ideas and thoughts on future infrastructure construction and changes for that.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Joseph, do you have an answer for Jeff?
It asks us to look long term and think about the trade-off between the value of that construction and the cost of losing those wetlands. And I think we've been short-sighted on that. And what you're seeing as a consequence, particularly of Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, that there's been a major effort to rebuild the natural protections at in southern Louisiana. It's hard to do. Biologically, it's hard to do. It's expensive, but that's really nature really provides a better defense system than we can build ourselves. So that's a really valuable option in some cases. In places, particularly in the East Coast, where you have cities built up right against the ocean on bays and on the water. Relocation is hard and it's expensive. And there you might say, well, we need to build the infrastructure to protect those places. But there are other places that are more lightly settled where it really makes sense, not only for the individual, but for society, given the social costs to help people relocate.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Go to Randy now in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi. I've been a carpenter for about 50 years, and I never understood why in hurricane-prone areas, I mean, they have them up on stilts now. I see that. But why they're not made circular or dome or even an octagon shape so that the wind will move around them rather than if you can take a quarter-inch thick 4x8 sheet of plywood in a 10, 15-mile-an-hour windy day, and I'll guarantee it'll rip it right out of your hands. And we're not even talking, you know, the winds of a hurricane. Why insurance companies or somebody doesn't require this.
Interesting. Randy, thanks. I hadn't heard about that, Joseph. I guess aerodynamic building design. Is that a thing?
It's a thing, but I don't think you see very much of it. Possibly it's related to the cost of construction. But in a lot of cases, there's uplift that for example, rips a roof off of a building, and if you will, the freeboard of the building probably wouldn't make a lot of difference. But there are construction details that can be changed that really make a lot of difference. So in a case where flooding is common, raising the elevation of a structure is typical along coastlines. But also doing simple things with construction, that is stronger construction joints for wood frame buildings, really make a difference. It's a matter of saying, I need to prepare for this, and I'm going to make the extra investment in building better.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about infrastructure amidst a changing climate. Joseph Schofer stays with us from Northwestern University. Back to your calls now. Chad is with us in Waterloo. Chad, hi.
Hey. Hi there. Great topic. My question is, in the Midwest here and in our state, what would be kind of the major issues that maybe we could have more focus on, or groups like the Department of Natural Resources, things like that, that maybe we could see a little more focus on? And what would worry you more? Something that would be weather related or more industrial related, like an accident or something like that?
Chad, thanks for the call. So Chad worried about not just natural, quote unquote, disasters, but industrial disasters as well. Is that part of our infrastructure thinking, Joseph?
It's something to think about. There, the issue falls very much more on the private sector on government regulatory processes. And there are industrial accidents that happen all over the world. They're not common, but they do happen. It's less of an infrastructure problem and more of a sort of a managing the operations problem. But I want to take you back to his other point, mm-hmm. which is what's specific for Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is, and you mentioned this, wildfires are not so rare in Wisconsin. Floods are not so rare in Wisconsin, and particularly the kind of flooding, two kinds of flooding that I can think of. One that just happened in New York, which makes the New York case of Hurricane Ida particularly important in terms of learning, and that is flash flooding. Flash flooding in a case where in New York City, flash flooding doesn't happen or didn't happen before, and it's fairly rare in other places. So one needs to be prepared for that in terms of design of infrastructure and building resilience into that infrastructure. But there are also dam failures. Dams are all over the nation. In Wisconsin, is not unusual in that sense. Recently, within the past year, two privately owned dams failed in the state of Michigan, which is not very, very far away, and created massive damage. It was a heavy rainstorm, and the dams failed in those cases. And one of the things we're seeing with dams, which we think about as kind of public infrastructure, is that a very large fraction of the dams in the United States are privately owned by agricultural establishments or local power companies, and may not be as well maintained as we'd like them to be to protect us from overtopping and failure.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a climate action coach. This is an excellent conversation. Prior to moving back to the Wisconsin area in 2017 to buy a farm, I lived in Colorado, California, Washington State, lived through forest fires, unprecedented windstorms. I was preparing for Cascadia Rising and the massive earthquakes that they predict will hit the West Coast and the tsunamis. And a lot of the money and infrastructure changes were happening to help with whatever they could mitigate, not everything. When I came back to Wisconsin a year after buying our farm, we had 60 plus unprecedented storms that were, you know, tornadoes and high winds, and lost just a ridiculous number of trees. And, you know, we've had the slow creep of climate change affecting a lot of our trees that were just devastated during these storms.
And Kelly, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time, but I mean, Kelly definitely makes it clear no place can ignore these issues, it sounds like, Joseph.
That's right. That is right. Nobody is immune, but and everybody has their private natural hazards. They vary substantially across the country, but they exist, and one needs to prepare for them. So one of the steps one needs to do in preparing is to be quite aware of what hazards we're exposed to in the place that we're living.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Joseph, I hope we can talk to you again. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to have had the conversation. Thank you very much.
That's Joseph Schofer, Professor Emeritus of Civil and Environmental Engineering for the McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University. You can hear him more on the podcast, The Infrastructure Show. He joined us today to talk about infrastructure and climate change. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show, Monday at 7:30. Should Colby become Wisconsin's state cheese? It was invented here, so why not? Find out more Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the successful effort of Milwaukee janitors to get a new union contract with a $15 base wage. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.